terrific to work with. Really appreciate you and getting the speakers lined up. But Paolo's going to introduce Morris, who needs no introduction, but he's going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So everybody, if you'd like to mute, if you'd like to mute yourself now, or I can do it for you, just start muting yourself now. Paolo, and I will pull up the Word document and share it with everyone, okay?
Okay.
Go ahead, Paolo, why don't you start?
Okay. So, I would say that it is really unnecessary to introduce Morris. We all know him well. You can intervene, Morris, if you want. We all know him well. He has been a member of our group since the beginning, 1963. And he was co-chair, along with Norbert Friedman, from 1990 to 2001. Our meetings with Morris are always very lively. He stimulates interventions, and his puns and jokes are a pleasure to all. However, I want to say a few words about him. He's from Brooklyn, and when he was young, his first training occurred in the streets. And thanks to this training, later at City College, he became a varsity member of his wrestling team. Later, he was also very much involved with music, and is still today. And for some years, he even worked as a producer of jazz concerts, which featured Charlie Mingus and his group. They remained friends until Mingus' death. Other things could be said about Morris CD, but it would take too much time here. I will only say few less important things about Morris, about his professional life, which is less important in a way. He studied at City College, as we said, where he was enrolled in its unique program in clinical psychology. Among his teachers, there were David Beers, Kurt Goldstein, Ernst Chris, Ruth Munro, Roy Schaefer, Catherine Wolf, etc. Later, he received his PhD at New York University, where he was a student of George Klein, and subsequently, he became a part of the NYU Research Center for Mental Health, directed by Bob Holt and George Klein, where he participated to the seminars of David Rappaport. Some of his colleagues at the time later became part of our group, such as Hartwig Dahl, Merton Gill, Leo Goldberger, Irving Paul, Fred Pine, Benjamin Rubinstein, Lloyd and Doris Silverman, Don Spence, David Bolitsky, Fran and Paul Lippmann, etc. In 1963, he became the director of the clinical psychology of York University in Toronto, Canada, where he was director of clinical training and chair of psychology department, and where he is now professor emeritus. After 18 years, he went to the Department of Applied Psychology of the Ontario Institute of Study of Education, OISE, at the University of Toronto. In 1995, he went back to New York, and at the Dirner Institute of Advanced Studies in Psychology of Adelphi University, where he is professor emeritus. In 2004, he moved to Los Angeles, where he was distinguished educator in residence at California Lutheran University, and currently is distinguished faculty member of the New Center for Psychoanalysis. Among other things, he was elected fellow at the Royal Society of Canada, president of a division of psychoanalysis of the American Psychological Association, recipient of the Sigourney Award in 1909, recipient of the New York Attachment Consortium Award, Contribution to Interface Between Attachment Theory and Psychoanalysis, Erickson Scholar in Residence at Ulster Rick Center, recipient of the Award for Distinguished Scientific Achievement of the American Psychological Association Division of Psychoanalysis, etc. He has been visiting professor in various universities, such as Cambridge University, England, University of California, Berkeley, University of St. Andrews, Scotland, New School for Social Research in New York, and so on. He spent 6 months at the Center of Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he had close contacts with Carl Hempel, whom he had admired during his college years, and Adolf Grunbaum, director of the center, with whom he developed an important scientific and personal relationship that lasted many years. He's in the editorial board of Psychological Issues and several journals, including, among others, Philosophy of the Social Sciences, Psychoanalytic Psychology, and the JAPA, where he's on the advisory board. He's also co-author, along with Linda Goodman, of the Research Education Section of the American Psychoanalytic Association Department of Psychoanalytic Education. He's the author of 5 books and editor of several books, and wrote more than 20 journal articles and chapters in edited books.
Left out a zero.
He's authored books, some of them translated in various languages, are Recent Development in Psychoanalysis, A Critical Evaluation, 1984, reprinted with Harvard University Press, 1987, From Classical to Contemporary Psychoanalysis, A Critique of Integration, 2011, Attachment and Psychoanalysis, Theory, Research, and Clinical Implication, 2014, and the 2 volumes, Core Concept in Classical Psychoanalysis and in Contemporary Psychoanalysis, both with the subtitle Clinical Research, Evidence, and Conceptual Critique, 2018. Now Morris has just completed the 5th book, in which he worked at the revision of the expansion of ego psychology. This is the subject of his presentation today, in which he will discuss the main arguments of his last effort. The title is Toward the Unified Psychoanalytic Theory, Foundation for a Revised and Expanded Ego Psychology. That's it. Okay, Morris.
Thank you, Paolo, very much. Okay, want me to start?
Yes.
You're all set, Morris.
Okay, I also want to thank Paolo and Craig very much for arranging this. I know how much work was put into it. Anyway, with an introduction like that, probably the best thing I could do is just, say thank you very much and leave. But I will read my paper, or at least discuss my paper. The paper and the book, in some way, more personal to me than anything else I've written in the following way, it sort of completes a circle for me from the time I spent at the NYU Research Center as a young man to my current book on ego psychology, rather late in my life as an old man. The dominant psychoanalytic ethos at the research center was in fact an ego psychology perspective, along with receptivity to cross-fertilization between psychoanalysis and ideas and findings from non-psychoanalytic sources. And I return to that ethos in my book, and I should probably say, not say return, because as I think about it, having 1 foot in psychological research and theory and 1 foot in psychoanalysis has always been at the center of much of what I've written and thought about. So it's a continuation as much as a return. So let me get to the book. The main claim I make in my book is that a corrected and revised ego psychology constitutes the strongest foundation for a unified psychoanalytic theory of the mind, a one that's best suited to integrate relevant findings from non-psychoanalytic sources, is best able to address and integrate the phenomena of primary interest to other psychoanalytic schools, and perhaps surprisingly, one that places what Hartman has referred to as the personal element, quote unquote, the I, at the center of psychological life. By the way, with regard to the discussion earlier, John Auerbach's comment that Lacan thought ego psychology was a terrible mistake, I find that still another reason that I might be on the right track.
It wasn't my comment, but thank you.
Okay, who was it? It doesn't matter. Anyway, I'll return to this last idea in the paper. Although I have a chapter on treatment in the book, the main focus is on a psychoanalytic theory of the mind rather than psychoanalysis as a form of treatment. And here I agree with Freud that psychoanalysis' main claim on posterity is as a theory of the mind rather than as a form of treatment. So, why ego psychology? Well, let me begin by describing how the idea for the book came about. I had been looking into research on individual differences in inhibitory capacity, including the ability to delay gratification, as well as other so-called executive functions. At a certain point, the links between this work and Freud's conceptualization of the ego in the project as a structure whose primary function is inhibition became evident. That connection became quite evident. And as we know, the basic ideas of the project were restated in psychological language in Freud's later writings. So even though he abandoned the project, the ideas are very much part of the corpus of his work. So central to the Freudian theory of the mind is the conception of the ego as a structure and a set of processes that intervene between impulse and discharge. And according to Freudian theory, in the normal course of events, development proceeds from an early direct pathway from impulse to immediate discharge, similar to what Freud referred to as a reflex arc. So from that to the increasing emergence of processes that intervene between impulse and discharge. And these intervening processes, which are often inhibitory in nature, enable a mediated pathway from desire to meaningful action. So I hope that's clear. From impulse to immediate discharge to desire, intervening processes, and meaningful action. And those intervening processes allow us to function in a complex world that requires delay, planning, awareness of means-ends relations, and anticipation of consequences through assessment of safety and danger. In short, as stated by Hartman, the ego is understood as, quote, an organ of adaptation, end of quote. And in an important sense, the appearance of these intervening processes marks the emergence of a person. And I'll say more about that later. I just also want to say that my wife, Rita, who's lying here in her pajamas, has written on this topic with much insight in a book entitled Help Him Make You Smile. Anyway, it seemed to me, back to how the idea for the book came about, it seemed to me that not only could an ego psychology perspective potentially assimilate and integrate relevant findings from non-psychoanalytic sources, but given the conception of the ego as a superordinate organizing structure, ego psychology could also address and integrate the main issues and concerns of different schools, which in my view have a more limited perspective and a more limited range. The conception of the ego as an organizing superordinate structure is made clear by Freud when he refers to it as, quote, a coherent organization of mental processes to which consciousness is attached and as a mental agency that controls the approaches to motility and that supervises all its own constituent processes, end of quote. Finally, and especially important, ego psychology locates what Hartman calls the personal element at the center of psychological life, where it always was meant to be. And by the way, that may be so surprising to us because of Hartman's experienced, distant, and austere language. But if you look at the substance of what he says, I think then his emphasis on, quote, the personal element becomes clear. For all these reasons, I felt and do that an ego psychology perspective could serve as the strongest foundation for a unified psychoanalytic theory of the mind. So that that's how the rationale for the book. Now, it's very clear, it became very clear to me that there are severe limitations and shortcomings in ego psychology as it currently exists. And that in order for it to serve as a foundation for a unified theory, these shortcomings, deficiencies need to be addressed. And a good part of the book addresses these shortcomings, not with the aim of simply criticizing them, but with the aim of pointing to the need for corrections and revisions. There's still another answer to the question of why ego psychology. And that is, its waning influence has unfortunately meant a relative loss of systematic interest on the part of the psychoanalytic community, at least in as it's expressed in different psychoanalytic schools. It's meant a loss of interest in some fundamental aspects of the mind that are addressed by ego psychology. For example, reality testing, defense, capacity to delay, affect regulation, and degree of integration of various aspects of the personality. These fundamental aspects of mental functioning should not be lost to psychoanalytic theory. Such a loss diminishes its range and importance. So let me turn to criticisms of ego psychology, and obviously I won't be covering all of them. I certainly am not going to comment about Lacan's criticisms, for example. There have been many criticisms directed toward ego psychology. Some of them more justified and some of them less justified. A good source for learning about some of these criticisms or reading about them, primarily in my view, the unjustified ones, is Bergman's book, 2000 book, The Hartman Era. So let me begin with what I believe is a major unjustified criticism of ego psychology. And then I'll turn to what I think are warranted criticisms. And once again, with the aim of pointing to the areas that really require correctives and revisions. A context in which ego psychology was subject to intense criticism was the debate, I think we're all old enough to remember that, was the debate in the 1960s and 70s on clinical theory versus metapsychology. A number of critics, including Merton Gill and George Klein, argued that the core of psychoanalysis lay in its clinical theory, and that psychoanalytic theory should be limited to the discourse of purposes, meanings, intentions, and so on. Insofar as the ego psychology of Hartman, as well as of Anna Freud, employed metapsychological language, energics, cathexes, and so on, neutralization, the critique of metapsychology was directed towards ego psychology. For example, according to George Klein, quote, proceeding in this direction, by which he meant explanation in terms of mechanism, rather than in terms of purpose, proceeding in this direction, ego psychology becomes indistinguishable from traditional academic psychology. It is certainly not psychoanalytic, end of quote. George also called for psychoanalysis, quote, to shed all pretenses of offering a non-teleological mechanistic picture of ego processes, end of quote. And a similar position was taken by other psychoanalytic commentators. By the way, for many of us, I bet it's a surprise to hear those quotes from George, because after all, his entire professional career, in a way, was devoted to a kind of cross-fertilization of research in psychology with psychoanalysis, and yet this is a position he took. Although this position may be defensible in the context of treatment, a question that arises is whether any psychoanalytic theory, including its clinical theory, any theory that purports to explain human behavior, can be justifiably limited solely to discourse in terms of aims, purposes, and motives. As the philosopher Max Black writes, quote, As soon as reasons for actions have been provided, an inquiring mind will want to press on to questions about the provenance and etiology of such reasons. I like that statement. It's, in addition to its substance, it's stated very eloquently. In other words, although appeal to the agent's reasons and motives as explanation may suffice in the context of everyday interaction and the clinical situation, at its deeper level, reasons and motives are phenomena that require explanations themselves. And by the way, with reference to Dr. Jackendorf's paper, in one of his books, he distinguishes between the phenomenal mind and the computational mind. And the insistence on the discourse of purposes, reasons, and aims is equivalent to insisting that somehow the deeper account of the computational mind should be stated in the language of the phenomenal mind. It's also important to note that although the specific metapsychology of Freudian theory and ego psychology may be of little explanatory value, and I think it is of little explanatory value, given its lack of empirical reference and so on. That is a point that I think John made a little while ago. It doesn't follow that one should eschew any attempt at searching for deeper levels of explanation. There's a conflation there between the inadequacy of Freudian metapsychology and the issue of explanatory accounts that are not in phenomenal experiential language. In short, this critique of ego psychology seems unwarranted. So let me turn now to criticisms that are warranted in that they point to deficiencies that need to be addressed and corrected. One such shortcoming is, although Hartman formulated the relative autonomy of ego functions from drives, he did not posit a similar autonomy of object relations from drives. That would have constituted too radical a break with Freudian theory, in particular its conception of the relationship between the object and drives. This step was left to others, mainly object relations theorists such as Ballant, Fairbairn, and others. One should also include Bowlby's proposal that attachment is linked to an autonomous instinctual system and not a derivative of other instinctual systems. It's worth noting, by the way, that a similar debate was taking place in academic psychology, one product of which was Harlow's classic experiment on the wire and terry cloth surrogate mothers, the main purpose of which was to refute the theory that the mother's role in drive reduction is the primary factor in the infant-mother bond. So that's clearly one area that needs to be addressed, and I try to do so in my book. A second criticism, ego psychology's neglect of object relations is also seen in its failure to adequately recognize the vital role of the object relational milieu in the development of ego functions. In his reference to, quote, an average expectable environment, Hartman essentially put on hold the issue of the influence of different environments, including their object relational aspects, on ego development. The incorporation of findings in this area is a vital task for the project of a revised and expanded ego psychology. And there's a huge literature in both psychoanalytic and non-psychoanalytic sources on this topic. And the findings include the impact on development, including ego development, of a wide range of object relational factors, including maternal responsiveness, peer and sibling relationships, and cultural and socioeconomic factors as they are object relationally implemented. Let me just provide a quick example or two. There's evidence that trust in a particular person, as well as generalized trust, is associated with greater delay of gratification. Also, simply a gentle touch on the shoulder of the child facilitates delay of gratification. And those are just ordinary examples. a more important example is, as we know that, as Bowlby wrote, the capacity to explore, which is certainly a critically important ego function, which is critical for the child's development of necessary knowledge and skills, is strongly influenced by the availability of a secure base. One can almost think of that as a model, by the way, of the relationship between object relational factors and ego functioning and ego development. Not only do toddlers literally explore a greater area, literally, physically a greater area, and with less anxiety when mother is physically present compared to when she's absent, but they also explore more and more comfortably when mother is simply physically present as compared to when she's present but doing something else, like reading a newspaper. So it isn't just her physical presence, it's her also availability. Even a photograph of mother facilitates the child's exploration. A third deficiency, a central one, probably an extremely important one, a central deficiency of ego psychology is its failure to adequately address the capacity for interpersonal and social understanding as a fundamental ego function. It's very good at telling, at explaining lack of understanding, but not so much about how we routinely understand each other. In view of the fact that we're social creatures, it's remarkable that as a theory of how the mind works, psychoanalytic theory, including ego psychology, does not have an adequate account of the processes involved in our routine, everyday understanding of each other. There's a large and complex theoretical and research literature on the processes involved in intersubjective and social understanding that would certainly need to be integrated into an adequate psychoanalytic theory of the nature of the mind. Let me just say a word or two about what is seen as processes that are involved in social and interpersonal understanding. There appears to be a general agreement that paralleling the fast and slow thinking identified by Kahneman and others, there are two systems implicated in interpersonal understanding. One fast, implicit, automatic, and reflexive, and the other slow, deliberative, inferential, and reflective, not reflexive. Much of the research on system one focuses on the role of the mirror neuron system in observing another's actions, emotional, facial expressions, and experience of pain, as well as other feelings. And although the motor neuron system is activated during observation of a motor act, it leads only to rudimentary and covert rather than overt mode behavior. This suggests, and what I'll try to show here, is the way this traces back to Freud's original insight regarding the nature of ego functioning, but that should become clear, I hope. Anyway, the fact of rudimentary imitation or quasi-imitation rather than overt motor behavior in observing another, and by the way, if you observe someone's facial expression, like smiling, the muscles in your face that get activated are identical to the ones that are activated in smiling, the one who's doing the smiling. That's an example of what I mean by rudimentary imitation, neural imitation, or muscular imitation. This suggests a mechanism that inhibits full-fledged imitation. An implication of this formulation is that were inhibitory mechanisms not present or impaired, full-fledged overt imitation would occur. And indeed, there's evidence to support this hypothesis. One source of such evidence is the presence of automatic, overt, quasi-imitative behavior in infancy prior to the development of inhibitory mechanisms. Another source of evidence is the presence of overt, automatic imitation in adults with frontal lobe damage. With regard to the latter, Luria observed that patients with frontal lobe damage automatically imitate every action they observed, condition he referred to as echopraxia. And Lehrmeyer and colleagues refer to, quote, obstinate imitative behavior, that is, an urge to imitate every observed action. And Darwin himself had already described people with certain brain diseases as showing, quote, echo signs, that is, imitating everything they perceive. And my former teacher, Kurt Goldstein, reported that if given a comb or a glass, frontal lobe patients could not refrain from respectively combing their hair or drinking, a phenomenon Goldstein referred to as stimulus boundedness. So, whereas in intact individuals, the perception of a glass or a comb evokes a rudimentary motor response. And by the way, there's also evidence that if you see a hammer, perceive a hammer, the areas of the brain that are involved in hammering get activated. Just the perception activates the motor area. So in brain damage patients, instead of a rudimentary motor response of the kind I just described, there's a full-fledged overt action. In other words, there's a failure of inhibition. Now, as for infancy, LePage and Theoret proposed that the imitative behavior seen in infants is essentially the product of what they refer to as, quote, uninhibited perception. As they put it, the newborn performs his perception. That's a very important idea. I hope you already see the connection to Freud's from impulse to immediate discharge. In other words, to perceive is to act. They propose that over time, quote, well, we don't need to, I don't need to cover that. The term uninhibited perception employed by LePage and Theoret suggests that the automatic quasi-imitative behavior observed in infancy is not so much imitation, it certainly is not intentional imitation, but rather the consequence of a relatively direct and automatic pathway from perception to execution. I hope you note the parallel from impulse to immediate discharge. And that's due to the relative absence of a mediating inhibitory process between the perception and the motor behavior. So there are implications of these findings regarding interpersonal understanding that should be made explicit. Put very simply, unmediated overt imitative behavior by itself is not conducive to understanding another. Imitating another is not understanding another. By the way, that's why the term mirroring always bothered me. Mother doesn't mirror the child's distress, for example. She engages in behavior that soothes the child. She doesn't cry when the child cries. This becomes clearer, somewhat clearer, in considering the role of empathy in interpersonal understanding. Posner and Rothbart suggest that there are different forms of empathy, one of which can be described as broadly as I feel what you feel, which may be largely underlain by the automatic reactive system, and the other of which can be described as I can imaginarily put myself in your place and experience a small dose of what you feel and understand what you feel, which may involve not only system one, but also greater recruitment of the deliberative control system. One of my students, Deborah Posner, no relation to the other Posner, found that participants who were high on anxious attachment were also high on an empathy scale that stresses the tendency to feel what others are feeling. A phenomenon that in its extreme form is akin to a contagion effect. Participants who showed secure attachment were high on an empathy scale that taps what one might call cognitive affective empathy. That is, quote, the cognitive or imaginative apprehension of another's condition or state of mind. Interestingly, by the way, the two measures of empathy were not significantly correlated with each other. There's also a great deal of research, huge literature, on correlates of personal distress reaction, I feel what you feel, compared with what I just called as cognitive affective empathy. And one of the a common finding is that the personal distress reaction is accompanied by avoidance of the person in distress, whereas the cognitive empathy is accompanied by helping the other. So when you're distressed, you want to get rid of your distress. Your focus is not on helping. So I move now to another area that needs a good deal of work. In 1953, Rappaport wrote, quote, "We do not possess a systematic statement of the psychoanalytic theory of affects," end of quote. And this is true not only of Freudian theory and of ego psychology, but also of post-Freudian psychoanalytic schools. For example, the terms affect and emotion do not appear at all in the index of Coet's 1984 book, How Does Analysis Cure?, nor do they appear in Mitchell's Relational Concepts in Psychoanalysis. Not a single entry. So, in what Rappaport refers to as phase three of Freud's theory of affects, Freud takes steps toward an adequate theory of affects, at least the affect of anxiety. In Inhibition, Symptoms, and Anxiety, Freud introduces the important idea of the appraisal function of affect, and in doing so, recognizes the experience of affect and its regulation as ego functions. As Freud writes, quote, "The ego is governed by considerations of safety. It makes use of the sensations of anxiety as a signal to give a warning of dangers that threaten its integrity," end of quote. Despite this important step, however, Freud's formulation of affect continues to be tethered to the metapsychological concepts of the pleasure principle when that's understood in terms of buildup and discharge of quantities of excitation. Hence, despite recognition of the importance of affects, motivational primacy continues to be given to discharge of excitation, in particular, discharge of excitation related to drives. When, however, the pleasure principle is freed from its metapsychological links, the motivational primacy of affect becomes apparent. As far back as 1945, Fenichel wrote, quote, "In the last analysis, any defense is a defense against affects," end of quote. And in 1981, Sandler wrote that the emphasis on gratification of instinctual drives needs to be replaced with the recognition that affects constitute the primary motivational factor in behavior. Much more to say about that, but let me move on to an ego psychology perspective on psychopathology. In the last few years, a number of papers have appeared in which it is proposed that underlying a wide range of psychopathology is a general dimension labeled the P as in Peter, or as in psychopathology, the P factor, a concept analogous to the G factor in assessments of intelligence. What makes the proposal of a P factor especially relevant in the present context is its parallel to what, from a psychoanalytic perspective, can be viewed as a general dimension of ego impairment expressed in different domains and that underlie different specific expressions of psychopathology. Indeed, Caspi and Muffet note that the idea of a general the idea of a general factor of psychopathology was anticipated by Ernest Jones in his 1946 valedictory address to the British Psychoanalytic Society. Jones writes, quote, "There may well be an innate factor akin to the general intelligence G, the nature of which still remains to be elucidated, but which may be of cardinal importance in the final endeavor to master the deepest infantile anxieties, to tolerate painful ego dystonic impulses or affects, and so to attain the balanced mentality that is our ideal, end of quote. He further describes the general factor, quote, as the capacity to endure the non-gratification of a wish, to retain the stimulating affects of an afferent impulse without immediately discharging them in an efferent direction. And as Caspian Muffet observed, Jones is suggesting that, quote, poor impulse control over affects, which they subsume under the category of deficits in response inhibition, is a core factor in psychopathology. And there's much fascinating longitudinal research in this area, which is in the book, obviously no time to discuss it here. I also want to note that many of the findings in this area can be seen as elaborations and empirical investigations of Freud's crucial insight regarding capacity for inhibition as a core ego function. Although this is quite interesting, reflects something about our culture, talking about last night. There's much research on relative failure of inhibition, interestingly, but there are a few studies on excessive inhibition. I found only two. From an ego psychology perspective, even though I've been talking about inhibition a lot, what's adaptive is not inhibition per se, but ego flexibility, that is the capacity for inhibition as well as disinhibition. That's discussed, by the way, in the concept of regression in the service of the ego, which I mentioned Danielle's paper. So on to the implications for treatment. An obvious implication of ego psychology for a psychoanalytic treatment is that however therapeutic change comes about, whether it's through insight, corrective emotional experience, empathic understanding, and so on, enhancement of ego function is a core aspect of positive therapeutic outcome. It should be included as an outcome factor. But I don't want to pursue that issue here because in the time that remains, I want to focus on what I think is the most important aspect of ego psychology. And I want to focus on the implications of where id was, there shall ego be, the full meaning of which is obscured by the English translation of the original German. These implications go beyond the treatment context. When unpacked, it seems to me they go to the heart of the ego of an ego psychology perspective. Let me begin by noting that neither Freud nor Hartman wrote about the ego, ego psychology, or ego functions. They didn't write about that. What they wrote about is das Ich, Ich Psychologie, and Ich Funktionen. In other words, they wrote about the I psychology, and I functions. Thus, quite ironically, despite the austere and experienced distant language that Hartman employs, he places the I, that is, the personal element, at the center of psychological functioning. When one translates the original German, wo es war, soll ich werden, literally into English, it is where it was, there shall I become. This translation can be even more freely understood as where impersonal it was, there shall personal I be or become. And even more freely as where experience of drivenness was, there shall a sense of agency be. Notably, these translations do not limit the impersonal I to drive impulses. The impersonal it can include any set of mental contents or potential experiences, because they are appraised as threatening to the stability and integrity of the individual, are rendered as an ego alien impersonal it. In fact, if you think of how people describe conscience or superego, a little man or little woman standing on your shoulder telling you what or what not to do, that is as much an it as the so-called, it's not integrated into it. Anyway, in the literal translation of where id was, there shall ego be, the goal of treatment becomes the transformation and enhanced integration of the hitherto ego-alien it into the personal I. Such integration not only expands the range of one's experiences and sense of agency, but also makes it more likely that the structure of a personal I will more adequately represent a wider range of one's vital needs and desires. Indeed, one can think of the evolutionary emergence of a personal I as an adaptive development that enhances the likelihood of one's vital needs being represented in a organizing structure and in experience, and therefore more likely to be met. This is still another way of understanding Hartman's positing of the ego as an organ of adaptation. One can also think of the I as a way station through which various factors, including biological and psychological needs and unconscious processes, exert their influence on us. That is, they do not do so the way a computer directs an automaton, but rather through exerting an influence on the I, what I desire, I prefer, I wish, I attend to, even if those I are conflictual, and what I want and intend to do. This concept of a way station is meant to capture the idea that with the development of an I, we are less subject to influences that proceed directly from impulse to action, back to Freud's original insight. Rather, these influences are mediated by the intervening structure of the I. So another circle is completed. That is, we've returned to the core of Freud's conception of the ego as an intervening inhibitory structure, and to Hartman's conception of the I as an organ of adaptation, and to his surprising emphasis on the personal element. The capacity for intervening processes and functions, such as planning, thinking, anticipating consequences, desiring, and so on, already implies the emergence of the I at the center of subjective experience. As Walsh writes in his summary of Kant's philosophical formulations, the existence of an I, quote, is the ultimate condition for experience in the sense of being the logical subject of experience, or the point to which all experience relates, end of quote. Further, whatever the factors that influence them, and whatever the underlying explanatory account, the fact is that it is one's lived experiences that make one's life meaningful. And it is these lived experiences that are the primary phenomena that need to be accounted for in any adequate theory of the mind. In that sense, contrary to Freud's endorsement of Grotthack's aphorism that we are lived by our id, we are lived by our ego, not by our id. Let me sum up. My main claim is that due to its superordinate organizing status, its ability to address the interests and concerns of other psychoanalytic schools, its ability to integrate findings from other disciplines, and above all, its placement of the personal element, the I, at the center of the personality, a revised ego psychology is best suited to serve as a foundation for a unified psychoanalytic theory of the mind. Thank you.
It's terrific, Urs.
So, there is, it's hard to hear. Am I on? Oh, wait.
Yes.
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay.
Doris.
So, okay, I'm going to begin. I think that this is a tour de force, Morris, of integration. It seems to me so different from some current thinkers, yep, like Jay Greenberg, and especially Fred Pine, who said, let a thousand theories bloom. It's also different from someone like Michaels, and especially Rachel Glass, who thinks the ego psychology that we have is absolutely okay, without her belief that any research is at all important. The fact that you're also providing a good deal of research to support your ideas is very important. of course, you and I have spent years now when we got together talking about Freudian theory. So I can remember when I, from my clinical work, began to think of the importance of affect as a key motivational feature. And you agreed with it. So there was a lot of overlap in our positions of what's significantly motivational in psychoanalysis. That's an ego function. And this is true especially for attachment theory, where the idea of an ego function became a very powerful motivational issue, so that when there's insecure attachment, when there's a lack of safety and security, it stirs anxiety. So we have the motive as well behind the experience of anxiety as motivational. I'm also assuming that you would put, for example, self-stability that gets stirred as a threatening experience, which would go along with Cohut's ideas that you want to integrate, that when the self is no longer experiencing itself as safe, anxiety is stirred. So it seems to me what you're saying is you're not giving up on drives, but that there are a lot of other functions, including ego functions, that are motivational for you. I want to make sure that you're in agreement with that. So that's one question that I raised.
The question of what?
Whether, for example, self-organization.
Okay, I understand, yeah.
Yeah. I also wanted to address the idea of adaptation. It isn't always beneficial. In the short run, for example, with infants, adaptation to a insecure attachment is adaptive, but in the long run, it's maladaptive. So it seems to me there has to be some more nuanced position in your role of adaptation. Where it is, there shall ego be. You talk about transformation or sublimation. I have a different idea about that as well. Or maybe it's what you mean, I'm not clear. For example, I have a highly obsessional patient that I work with who is overly inhibited. Recently, he was able to talk about sexual fantasies that he had about the two of us. When it was over, he said to me, I've spent 3 years in analysis, and this is the first time I felt free to talk about it. And what a relief it is for me to be able to talk about it. It isn't transformational. There's still lots of issues about his inhibition in sexuality, but it was such a relief and a sense of gratification. And of course, there is also a change in superego that gets integrated in a different way. So I also wondered what you thought about that, rather than just transformation or sublimation.
Okay, good. Lots of interest. I have three questions: the self-stability, the adaptation, and the patient who's the obsessional patient, right? Yes. Yeah. With regard to the self-stability I discuss it at length in the book, that self-stability and identity, self-cohesiveness, what the terms that Cohut uses, are clearly integratable into ego psychology. And in fact, I don't have it in front of me. There's a wonderful quote that from Cohut, who talks about his self-psychology as essentially an extension of ego psychology. And then he writes, however, ego psychology doesn't have the armamentarium to deal with the issues that I deal with, something of that sort. So I don't think that's obviously self-stability, ego identity, certainly can be viewed as an ego function, not just adding on ego functions, but there's nothing contradictory about that. Yeah, however, I do want to make another point, which I make in the book, that the contributions of various schools, and there are indeed contributions, they often point to phenomena that are neglected by existing theory. But instead of incremental additions and revisions, there is what I call the narcissism of theory building, or a form of reductionism. Namely, one reductionism replaces another. So instead of adding the importance of self-stability, it becomes an entirely new school. And it's supposed to substitute for, replace the old school. That's one of the problems. I don't think there's any particular problem with covering self-stability and the maintenance of it as a motive, which when it gets disturbed, as you point out, triggers anxiety. In other words, that's certainly one area where defense would operate to reduce anxiety, to threats. If you look at the early cases of Freud, they all have to do with threats to self-esteem. So that's number one. Number two, your comment about adaptation in the short and the long, short run and long run, I have a huge section devoted to that. So I'm glad you brought it up. Yes, there can be short-term adaptation and long-term adaptation. Let me give you an example. Ability to delay gratification in poverty environments, or what's called resource-scarce environments. It's been argued that immediate gratification, if you're in a resource-scarce environment, is highly adaptive. Because if you wait too long, the reward won't be there. Get it? Yeah, in other words, why wait? Take it when you can. So, however, in the long term, if you are somewhat mobile and you grow up and you move to a different environment, it's no longer adaptive. It's now maladaptive, the delay of gratification. Furthermore, there's a third factor, that sometimes what looks like short-term adaptation has terrible costs. So, for example, yes, it's true that immediate gratification may be adaptive in a resource-scarce environment. But what we know is that kids who grow up in poverty have marked changes in brain structure, including thinner gray matter, et cetera, et cetera. So something that looks like a short-term adaptation is also unfortunately associated with terrible costs. So the point is that the notion of short-term adaptation, for example, in resource-scarce environments is hardly the full story. The maladaptation, unfortunately, is far more grim and marked and often permanent. So the final thing about your patient, a person can be very obsessive and inhibited, as you put it, but that isn't what I meant by inhibition. So for example, let's say you have an obsessive patient who cannot help but engage in either obsessive thoughts or let's say compulsive acts like hand washing. That's a failure of inhibition. They cannot inhibit the prepotent response of washing their hand. So one has to distinguish between the descriptive sense of inhibition and the sense in which Freud had in mind. I don't know if I'm making that clear. So, well, for example, take that example. You can't help but wash your hands. That's a failure of inhibition. Mm-hmm. The failure to be able to inhibit a prepotent response. So even in a highly inhibited patient, you can have areas of failure of inhibition as well as excessive inhibition. Uh-huh. I don't know if I dealt with all three. Yeah.
No. Well, but no, about the transformation.
Oh yes, that's right. Right. You're right about that. I was really referring to it as an ideal rather than a practical, achievable outcome. I totally agree with you. that very often the transformation does not occur. You just learn to live with it. Reminds me of my friend Jerry Wakefield referred to people who come out of analysis. How did he put it? They're now able to have a prosthetic device. So you could walk with crutches. It's better to be able to walk than not walk at all. So the ideal, of course, is transformation of desire and sublimation. You don't find it that. It's good enough. The outcome is often good enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, what happened? Did I get mute? No. Can you hear me?
John, go ahead.
Okay. So, Morris, as always, the paper is so eloquently written and so richly detailed and informed that it's almost hard to find a disagreement, but I'm like that anyway. So the concern, I mean, because I agree with the general point, which is that psychoanalysis needs something to identify what it's, to replace what its metapsychology was. It needs something that integrates all these different areas of psychological research. I agree with the main point. My question is, or my concern is more about the question of what das Ich, the ego, actually is in psychoanalysis. And though I don't have much sympathy at all for Lacan's views, and I'm troubled by what's now a commonly quoted statement, this is Philip Bromberg's, that health is the ability to feel like oneself while being many. There's a point to this. Because as I understand what Freud meant by das Ich, he actually meant it to be a locus of conflict. I'll go backwards first in time and say, so the first true it psychologist isn't Grodek, it's Nietzsche. It's from where he takes the concept of the ego and says, no, this is just a grammatical fiction, and it thinks rather than I think or the ego thinks. And I think that's overstated, and I think Rambo's evocative statement, I is another, is overstated. And I think that's at the core of the Lacanian view. But nonetheless, so I think if we look at the foundational text really for Freud's thoughts on the ego, which is really on narcissism, really more that than the ego and the id, you see it's governed by two oppositions. One is between ego interests and libidinal interests, and the other is between ego libido and object libido.
Mm-hmm.
Only if you read this carefully do you understand that ego interest versus libidinal interest, that's that I that's in the ego psychology. That's the ego that's an agentive factor, a regulatory factor. But it wouldn't make sense in the other opposition between ego libido and object libido. That's libido I invest in myself versus libido I invest in others. And if we understand this structure, then maybe first of all, we don't need the division between ego psychology and self psychology, because there's just an ich psychology. And second, it would mean that something like health isn't just that we have adaptation and regulation and integration, but that integration involves this idea that this thing that's doing this integration is a potentially conflicted structure at all times. And really what's working is whether those potential conflicts are better integrated or worse integrated, but not that they're not there, because if you have this constant tension between I as an agent and me as a self at all times in the concept of the ego, then it looks and sounds a lot different from just I'm going to be better integrated if I'm healthy. So I'm wondering whether what you make of that idea, and if it's at all helpful in terms of getting this to something more complex, because I think the psychoanalytic I is more complex than the I that people reflexively have, which is the Invictus I.
Which is what?
The Invictus I.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I'm the captain of my fate, I am the master, right?
Right.
My soul, right? And the whole point of a psychoanalytic understanding of what this I is of a much more complex potentially decentered state. I won't put it as, I think, extremely and as nihilistically as they do in Lacanian prose, where you wonder whether there's an I there at all. Mm-hmm. But I would put it as okay. A potential. Yeah.
Well, that's a lot. I'll try to respond to at least some of what you said. First of all, with regard to the I as a locus of conflict, I don't see that as a, you know, particularly difficult issue. When you say I am in conflict or I am not in conflict, they're both the locus of the I. So I think you probably would agree that that central to psychoanalysis, Freud, Lacan, is the notion of the of conflict. And of course, the ideal, which is a little bit related to Doris's question, the ideal is integration, harmony. And by the way, some good examples of that. It's not just a psychoanalytic issue, but it's an age-old ideal. This is a paraphrase that it's at the age of 70. This it goes. Confucius said, how did he put it? Oh yeah, the desires of my heart and my sense of right and wrong were one and the same. In other words, he had achieved harmony. A cynical friend of mine, said, sure, at 70, it's easy to do that. Don't have the raging desires. Or even Kierkegaard, a purity of heart is wanting one thing. You know, it's clearly an ideal, a spiritual ideal of unity and an absence of conflict. But there's still an I who is in conflict. But so that's one thing. I agree with you about the notion of the locus of conflict. You also mentioned the ego interests, ego libido, object libido. In Our Narcissism, which I agree with you, is one of the most important of Freud's essays. And I don't think that's a problem. There's a section in the book where I talk about narcissism and that, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to summarize it in a short time. The whole notion of intentionality in Brentano's sense, namely, you know, relation to the other, to the outside world, we're not meant to simply focus on ourselves. We're constructed in such a way that. And this is the essence, one of the core insights of Freud's On Narcissism. We're constructed in such a way that our ego functions are generally directed outward. And that, in fact, an excessive focus on the self, Freud viewed as essentially, and therefore a depletion of libido towards the world is what he viewed as a core feature of schizophrenia, if you remember. So when I talk about the I, it's not in the sense of focus on the self. It's the I as agent acting upon the world. We engage in self-reflection when something goes wrong or when we want to get more information about ourselves. So I'm not sure what the problem is about ego libido versus object libido. The fact is that generally speaking, and this is true even in Kohut, the good life is a life in which libido is directed toward the object, not towards oneself. When he talks, even the paradox is he talks essentially about a self-realization. But what self-realization if not pursuing talents and aptitudes and abilities in the world, in the outside world. So I'm not sure what the problem is there, but maybe you could tell. Oh, the idea of, you said, what is the I, oh yeah, it feels, it thinks, mm-hmm. You know, the fact is that for all of us here, when I said that what's at the center of of our lives is our lived experiences. It's all well and good to talk philosophically about what does the I mean, but we wouldn't, our lives are made or broken by how, what I want, what I feel, what I think. And it has a kind of axiomatic understanding. And let me just say one other thing about that. You know who captures that, it seems to me, best of all is George H. Meade when he talks about the distinction between the I and the me. That, you know, any center of lived experiences, however one looks upon it philosophically, puts the I, or what I feel, I think, not the I as a structure, but the I as the center of activity, including conflict, puts that at the center of our lives. And think of it. Would our lives have any meaning if that were not the case? I mean, automatons behave, animals behave, they do things. What distinguishes us, it seems to me, is there is a center of existence, of lived experience, and much of what we do and feel has to do with that center. I'm not being very eloquent, to use your word, but I'm groping for it. It's a very difficult concept. I want to say one other, by the way, with regard to self-psychology, you know, Freud did, and Hartman didn't call ego psychology Selbstpsychology, they called it Ich psychology. And I don't think that's just a matter of language, because if you take Mead's distinctions, the I is the agent of action, of experience, and the me is a representation. When you say, I'm looking at myself, myself is an object of, it's a representation, just as you could say, I'm looking at the other person. Both are representations. One is a self-representation, the other is an object representation. And the I, and this is clearly what Hartman had in mind, it seems to me, is a set of processes and functions and subjective experience, or the locus of it, whereas the self, like take something like a deficit in the self, that self defects that Cohut writes about. Well, what is that really? I mean, if one unpacks it, it becomes essentially failures in self-esteem, failures in self-regulation, disintegration anxiety that he talks about, right? They become indistinguishable from ego impairments. Failures of ego identity, of continuity, of affect regulation, and so on. So I don't think we really need a self-psychology to cover the phenomena that self-psychology deals with. We need an ego psychology to expand so that it faithfully and efficiently deals with the phenomena that are of major interest to other schools. Let's see if I don't know if I've covered I think that, oh yeah, the notion of ego interests. That's an interesting one, what Hartman called Ich Interesse. But you know the context for that, John? It had very little to do with narcissism. It had to do with Hartman's reluctance to give full motivational effectiveness to ego rather than to drive. So he compromised by saying, yes, we have ego interests. They're in the service of self-preservation. They have to do with career, earning money, gaining recognition, but that's not the really deep stuff. That's what he meant by ego interest, by the way. So I don't think that's essentially a problematic issue.
Somehow I didn't put my point clearly enough, because I feel like my point was something more like this. I think Freud means for there to be one word, das Ich, to mean both ego and self. And that by nature makes it an unstable concept. Another way of looking at it is that Hartman tried to clean up the language, his paper on the ego, by saying, okay, we'll have an ego, a self, and a self-representation. And that makes it a whole lot easier to read, but it also gets rid of a certain tension that I think is meant to be inside the concept. And to me, the idea isn't getting all my purposes unified. The idea for me, if this is a somewhat unstable concept, is how to live with having internal contradictions.
I don't see that. I don't see the contradictions.
That worked in my life.
Pardon me?
At least as a personal statement, that worked better.
Oh, yeah. Well, those are contradictions within the I.
Yeah.
The I in conflict, the one you started with. That I totally agree with you.
And that's what the point was. And I think the wisdom of Freud's concept is that it means for the I to be this place where you live with conflicts and contradictions. Oh,
but by the way, that's at the core of where it was, there shall I ego be. Yes. If there weren't conflict, you wouldn't have that aphorism.
Yes. Yeah, you wouldn't need it.
Yeah, you wouldn't need it.
That was the thought.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
Larry, you're up.
Can I be heard now? Right.
Oh, yeah, Larry.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Morris. I think I have really so many comments that I don't want to hog the airtime, but I'll maybe try to get a few of them. I really love the way that you have deconstructed the idea that you can do without theory or just have a clinical theory and just stop your questioning at a certain point. People can do that, and they do it commonly now, but that's when you've abandoned the idea of theorizing, which mm-hmm. is, I think, where our culture is heading. However, I certainly agree with you that it's not an intellectually tenable situation, and it's not one that could be that will perpetuate psychoanalysis. But the other half of your presentation, it seems to me, which is extremely rich and rewarding in itself, is clearly the Hartmann and ego psychology that is the target of the anti-Hartmann people. And in some ways could be characterized as saying, well, Hartmann had an ego, and in that ego, you can put all of the empirical research that we have about the human condition, and that you have, and that makes for a very interesting account, which you've given, which I enjoy. But it does seem to me, and I think you maybe will agree with this, and it is also related to, it's pretty much what John said, but in another, with a different affect. There, Hartmann is, you can read Hartmann two ways. Very similarly, I think, the way you can read Kant two ways, in an anthropological way or in a transcendent way. You can say that Hartmann is the Hartmann of the neutral ego. And that's sort of, in a way, what you've said, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Or you could say, what he was getting at is what he called the Gesamtheit, which is the other, that's what's just referred to by John, the overall mind, really. And the ambiguity between these makes for the direction that you will go in, and makes also for a ambiguity and a contradiction that can't be resolved, I think, by any theory of the mind, but it is an ambiguity. So when you say, for example, just to take an example, you quote Freud at the end of your account saying, there shall ego be, that certainly is not the ego you started out with. You're not saying, you know, where the id was. Now you have vision, or now you have you can distinguish a mother of this sort from a mother of that sort. You're talking about the Gesamtheit, the overall person. I myself feel that's where Hartmann was developing in his theory as he went along, and that he was pinioned onto the idea of neutral faculties would not work, and it wouldn't work for reasons that I think Lowell pointed out, which is that it basically is going to have to deal with an object that is not libidinally relevant, and then make it libidinally relevant by bringing it into the mind. So the problem of bringing the objective outside into the subjective inside is a problem, I think, that basically Hartmann was working on, but really working on it. And I think he understood. He started out in his life debating with the phenomenologists, and taking them seriously enough to debate them. I think that by the end of his career, you could show that he had conceded a great deal to them. And I agree with you that he was really the prophet in many ways of trying to make more shades of meaning. He thought the way he would do it would allow the clinician, for example, to find more detail and more shades. It was exactly the opposite to what he was taken to be by people who have trashed him since. I'm certainly on your side with regard to that. So and by the way, just to get it in, the adaptation thing always drives me crazy. I mean, the main thing Hartman was, even from the beginning, was that it was adaptedness, not adaptation. Adaptedness, man being an evolutionary creature, was designed for certain ways, to react in certain ways, not designed to be a chameleon. The quotation that I love the most from Hartman is, a man must, or one must be able to must.
Must, yeah.
That was, you know, it isn't, if you were to do everything in a reasonable fashion, you'd be most unadapted. Mm-hmm. So somebody mentioned that, you know, you could be, quote, adapted to a bad mother. But, you know, the fact is, when he spoke about being adapted, he wasn't speaking about child raising or something. He was speaking about the organization of man as given in the evolutionary sequence. And one of the things that he needs in his overall eye, the Gesamtheit, would be not just to, as you correctly mentioned, it's not just to be able to restrain himself, but under certain circumstances to let loose and not restrain himself and not mm-hmm. think twice. So, but what happens if you read Hartman as working toward a theory of the mind overall, which he rightly felt Freud hadn't quite pieced together, and trying to do it by unifying the mind around the id or libido, and trying to make it encompass conflict, the installation of conflicting institutions, and trying to bring a meaningless world outside, that is meaningless in the terms that we talk about what things mean to us, into connection with something that has meaning, for example, is cathected, which is what an object is. That problem, I think, is a general problem of mind, and I think he did a pretty good job of trying to do it, and ended up really, I think, somewhere, you know, with picturing the mind as, according to the Piagetian principle, really. So, but I won't go into that. I give you the challenge, in addition to my compliments and my thanks for the education and the pieces that you might see. I see you as having assembled pieces of empiric, of physiology, if you like, which would be assembled into the ego and used somehow by a meaningful ich. That was informative to me. I think we should all know that. But to challenge you as to the whether that is what art, whether it works, I guess, basically. I'm not saying that anybody could work it. One last comment that the, I think when people do, I want the treatment problem is something that interests me, because I think the problem for a theory of the mind for an analyst is to have a mind that an analyst can talk to. And that's the I that you come out with at the end. But I think that what happens when people do study this and get then and start thinking in the composite way, they start thinking according to behaviorist standards. I'm just saying this is what I've seen among candidates. They're not addressing the Gesamtheit anymore. They are thinking of the bits and pieces that you say, especially. And one last, and I really will desist. when will you consider and think about, and then maybe reply or not, this is exactly, when Freud at the end of his life said, "Look, I never meant for the ego to be taken literally. I mean, I think this was an extraordinary statement. He said, these are diagrams in a way. Unfortunately, in effect, he was saying, unfortunately, very few people, I forget the exact quote, have an unmodified ego. And if you stop and think about what that meant when he said it, that, you know, he was kind of sour on mankind at that point.
Yeah.
What it means in theoretically overall, I think you get a different feeling of what the ego actually is. In other words, not a lens, but an expression itself of, in a sense, of the meaning in the world. And therefore, doesn't match exactly what a laboratory will come up with.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot, Larry. Can you hear me?
If I can, and I'm
okay. Well, I'll start with the last one because it's the recency effect. I'm not sure I can address all the issues you raise adequately or even at all, but the last one. About Freud saying, I never meant for the ego to be taken literally. My thought about that was what that reflects is what has been, and maybe this underlies a lot of what the other comments too. It seems to me what that reflects in part is what Ricoeur referred to as the constant tension in Freudian theory between mechanism and meaning, or what he called, I think, energics and meaning, right? Larry, would you agree? Yeah. So, that's a real problem, and I don't know that anyone could solve it, so to speak. It's essentially, in part, the mind-body problem.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's comment number one. Comment number two, even though I talk a lot about Freud and Hartman, and particularly Hartman, my focus on Hartman is because he's sort of a prophet of ego psychology. And it's a good way to, there's certainly no better way to start. But I wouldn't want to limit what I think ego psychology can be to simply an elaboration of Hartman or his views. I think the openness to, for example, to theory and findings from non-psychoanalytic sources could be quite useful. And by the way, it's also what Hartman believed himself. One of the reasons he thought ego psychology could be the basis for general psychology, because it was the best candidate for assimilating and integrating findings from non-psychoanalytic sources. And I think he was right about that. What else? Oh yeah, the adaptedness versus adaptation. I agree with you. In fact, the ambiguity of the language has led some people to criticize Hartman in a terribly unfair way. They equated his notion of adaptation with conformity.
Absolutely.
There was a whole slew of criticisms that Hartman was just telling people to conform to society, and he was a capitalist stooge or whatever. So I'm glad you brought up that point. I appreciate it. However, I do want to say that the way I understand evolutionary theory, I think it's correct, adaptedness is not a characteristic of an individual. It's always adaptedness to a particular environmental niche. So it does include interaction between the individual and the surrounding environment, but it's not conformity.
Well, Morris, it's adaptedness to the predictable
that's right.
environment, that evolution. And I think that he meant what it was designed for, as he was going, was it has to work. This machine we're talking about
is designed
to work.
Yes, that's what we're agreeing on, that, right. I'm just saying that it's not like you could say one person has more adaptiveness than another. No. If they're in different environmental niches, that's a meaningless statement. That's what, if you say, let's say there are, each is adapting to a different environmental demand or even a predicted environmental demand, then it's meaningless to refer to it in trait-like fashion. That's my point.
We have a little bit of a difference, but
okay. Let's see what else. The point you made, Larry, about, you know, at certain points, Hartman writes as if the ego is the person, the overall mind, as you put it, and at other times he writes as if it's a set of almost subpersonal functions. Like defense.
Miscellaneous functions.
Miscellaneous functions. And that's part of that challenge of meaning a mechanism or hermeneutics. And I'm aware of that. I'm not sure I can solve that. Except I think it can be better integrated than it is in Freudian theory and in Hartmanian theory. But I agree with you that that's a major challenge. And that's, by the way, that also partly accounts for the ambiguity, the issue that John raised, that you raised about what is the I, you know, what does it mean? Now, the conceptual challenge, by the way, which in a way George bypassed rather than confronted when he said, you know, no non-teleological terms. How do you integrate the concept of I functions? Right. With I as a phenomenological concept, as a center of subjective experience. I think that's partly what you had in mind, right, Larry?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a real challenge. And I think there are ways of approaching it. It's in the book, but whether I do it adequately or not remains to be seen. But I do appreciate the issues you brought up, and you did say you don't know if it can be resolved. I don't know, do we deal with it like two universes of discourse? Do we deal with it? I don't know. But one way I thought of dealing with it, just a little taste of it, is that certain failures of ego function do have repercussions for how you experience the world as an I. And in that sense, they're connected. And maybe it's bidirectional. I don't know. I don't want to give explanatory primacy to one or the other. That might be a hint about how you, that if ego impairments are sufficiently severe, you will have a different I and a different experience of yourself and the world. Something like that. But that's as far as I can go for the moment.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Larry.
Anne, you're up.
Okay. I'm really glad you wrote this book, Morris, because I feel like ego psychology has been unfairly shafted. And I agree with you that it presents the most likely basis for an elaborated theory of the mind and of development. So I have a very low level question to ask, but it sounds like I'm not the only one who doesn't quite know what an ego is. And that is, when I finished graduate school in cognitive development and psycholinguistics and started doing clinical work and people talked to me about the ego, I really had no idea what they were talking about. You know, in cognitive psychology, developmental psycholinguistics, there was no such structure. So what were they talking about? And fortunately, I began in my first job also by doing psych testing. And in the course of doing psych testing, I came to the conclusion for myself that the ego was a compilation of functions like language, perception, memory, reasoning, and some capacity to regulate and integrate those functions. And that's how you define the ego, as an organizing superordinate structures, structure. But, you know, there's the organizing function, the regulating function, and then there are the things that are being regulated, the functions like language, perception, memory, and reasoning. I think in the 90s, Fodor wrote that book called The Modularity of Mind, in which he talked about whether mind could be considered as a group of modular functions. And in that book, he argues that they're not all the same, that, mm-hmm. for example, language is modular in that it has domain-specific rules that don't apply elsewhere. Not the embedding function wouldn't be an example of that, but needing, for example, to have suffixes, prefixes, needing to have tense indicated, a variety of things like that that were domain specific to language. Whereas reasoning was one of those functions that he argued operated across domains. The reasoning operated in language and perception and memory, and so on. So it's never been clear to me up to this even moment what it is that the ego is. It's a complicated thing to say that it is both a compilation of mental functions, like the list that I read, some of whom are very different from the others in that compilation in their structure and functioning. And it's also the capacity to regulate and integrate those various functions. I think I would be hard pressed to define to a candidate at an analytic institute, because that's the only person I could think of who could possibly care, what an ego is.
Okay. I don't think going back to Larry's comment about Freud's, one of his latest comments, never meant for the ego to be taken literally. Very few concepts or constructs are taken literally, but I think essentially, even though you said, I don't know what the ego is, you actually defined it quite well, a superordinate structure that coordinates a different, it's both, and Hartman makes this point, it's both a set of functions, like motility, memory, and so on. And that's part of the tension, why the term is ambiguous. So it's both a set of functions and a superordinate structure that coordinates these functions. I mean, that's as good as, it's true. By the way, when cognitive psychologists talk about executive functions, like delay and response inhibition and ability to shift sets and so on, no one says, I don't know what you mean by executive function, because the answer is clear. They tell you what they mean. And we do the same when we talk about ego functions. I don't know why that's a special problem for psychoanalysis. The special problem comes in, and I think that's what you may be talking about, Anne. In a way, it's similar to Larry. How does that relate to what we call I? These are I functions, and that's the challenge. But I do think even that can be at least responded to in a broad way. There are different perspectives. It's like two different languages. One is a set of functions, among the ones you describe. That's looking at the individual in terms of their behavioral capacities, their problem-solving capacities, what they do with the world, and so on. And I think this is why the term ich psychology is important. At another level, or from a different perspective, it somehow makes a connection with I as lived experiences. They're not separate. They're different perspectives, and they're not interchangeable, but somehow we should not view them as entirely dissociate or separate from each other. There's a link there that we shouldn't overlook, because after all, what's important for all of us are lived experiences as persons. You can't let go of that if you want to write about a theory of the mind. So you have to include not just the reasoning and the motility, you have to ask the question, what?
Memory.
And memory, a whole bunch of things. So you have to then at least look at how this relates to how I experience my life, myself, etc. That's all I'm, what? Yeah, how I identify myself, etc. So that's all I'm saying. With regard to FODA, I'm glad you brought up FODA. I mean, by the way, you know, there's a big debate about whether modular theory is an adequate theory of the mind, but I kind of like some of the stuff he's written, as I think you do. My favorite example of his notion of a module that functions on its own and can't be influenced by other modules is a Miller-Lyer illusion. You see one line longer than the other, and the reason you do is that module leads to that experience, and even though you know better, the reasoning module doesn't have any effect on it. It's an independent module. It's an interesting...
That contradicts his claim, though, that reasoning applies across all domains.
But that's true. But I think it's not quite that way. He doesn't say it applies across all domains. It's a coordinating organizational meta module.
Right, but which is why it has to take in perception, for example, right, but, and it doesn't override the perceptual.
Right. But his explanation for that is, let's say the module that's responsible for the Miller-Lyer illusion is highly, forgive the word, it's based on algorithms and principles that generally work and that are very useful for you. So that's sort of the price you pay for having that module do that kind of work. You know what I'm talking about. So anyway, let's see. Yeah, I hope I've responded. Oh, I think that's it. Hardly low-level question.
Can I ask? Hi, Morris.
Hi, Wilma.
I think you're addressing from a lot of perspectives the difficulties of humans studying themselves, mm-hmm. studying all of that is the problem all through psychology, and why people build theories and constructs and concepts and try to connect them to each other in order to get through this issue of meaning and mechanisms or functions and phenomenology, you know, that you talk about. In the context of this, I was wondering why the word consciousness or unconscious hasn't appeared in this whole discussion.
Good question.
I'd like you to talk about that.
And okay, very
and
good.
And relate that to everything that you've said so far.
Yes, yes. It appears throughout the book. but very good question. And it's a difficult question. I don't equate I with consciousness, by the way, even though the ego, as Freud says, is the seat of consciousness, but he obviously also said there were ego functions that are unconscious, like defense. We know that, even though here's the way I think of it. And I'm hesitant to go in this direction because I'm going to get slammed. But I do think, let me make sure I want to say this, but I do think that subjective conscious experience are the core phenomena that any theory of the mind, including psychoanalysis, has to begin with. And take it seriously as phenomena to be explained, not to be dismissed as simply manifest content for which I, the mentioned Kenno, will tell you the latent meaning of what Ricoeur called the hermeneutics of suspicion. What you see is not what you get. I will tell you what's really there. I think to the extent that psychoanalysis moved in that direction, it was a big mistake. So there's a distinction to be made. I hope this answers your, at least deals with it. There's a distinction to be made, Wilma, between unconscious processes as explanatory concepts and processes explanatory in the sense that they provide a deeper explanatory meaning for the phenomenal conscious experiences. The distinction between that, like for example, forget about the dynamic unconscious, I use the example of size constancy, right? There are all sorts of what Dr. Jackendorf would call computational processes that account for my ability to size constancy, right? And they're inaccessible to consciousness. They are profoundly unconscious, not in a dynamic sense. They have an explanatory role in helping us in explaining size constancy, using that as a model. However, no one says, oh, what you really are experiencing is different sizes when you look at objects at different distances, because we know from your retinal image, blah, blah, blah. In other words, the phenomenal experience of size constancy has an integrity of its own, and then the explanatory, deeper explanation tells you how it comes about. I think that's a good model for psychoanalytic use of the unconscious. The problem arises that, different from my example, in psychoanalysis, it's that the unconscious, and here I do talk about the dynamic unconscious, the unconscious wish, for example, is not employed as an explanation for the conscious wish. It's employed in telling you that that's not what you're really wishing. What you're really wishing is the unconscious wish. And that is what an example of what Ricoeur calls the hermeneutics of suspicion. My view would be that the conscious wish is what you're wishing consciously. However, it's a product of defense. It's the story is incomplete. A deeper and fuller explanation would be such and such, which would involve. The problem with psychoanalytic explanation is the level of discourse for the both conscious and unconscious is still the wish. The level of discourse in the size constancy example is a computational level and a phenomenal experience level. And that problem, I don't think, has ever been worked out, because after all, an unconscious wish is potentially a phenomenal experience if you lift defense, right? It's not of a different level of discourse. And so to use—
I understand that. Unconscious wish.
An unconscious wish is, as Freud tells you, no different from a conscious wish, except that it hasn't conscious. It does not have consciousness attached to it. So that lends itself to the hermeneutics of suspicion, meaning that it's your unconscious wish that is really what you desire. It's not an explanation for your conscious experience. It's a replacement, so to speak. The model is manifest content and latent meaning. That's the model. That has never really been fully worked through in psychoanalytic theory. And that leads to, as I said, what Ricoeur calls a hermeneutics of suspicion rather than a hermeneutics of explanation. It's a big problem. The final thing I want to get at about consciousness and unconsciousness is I don't believe defenses are unconscious. There's so much evidence that here I have to invoke William James. We talk about consciousness as if it weren't dimensional. And by the way, also Paul Gray, when he talks about a close process of tension right below the surface, he clearly is telling us that his view of defense is it's right below the surface, it's preconscious, and if you direct the patient's attention to it, there's no deeply repressed defense. So all that stuff needs to be worked through in the relationship, in the psychoanalytic view of unconscious processes. I don't know, does that address your question at all?
I don't think it's addressable, really. In the sense.
Why not? Why not address it in the way I just described?
Because I still, people talk about psychoanalysis.
Let me give you an example of your work where it.
Okay, go ahead. People talk about almost everybody when you ask what is psychoanalysis about.
I know that
it's about the unconscious.
They can say it. So what?
And that's what I don't understand.
That's a poll. That's a survey. It's not a careful analysis of theory. It's what people think of.
That's what they tell everybody. That's the
problem. So what? It may be wrong.
Oh, I'm sure it's wrong. But you see, if we think about presenting this field to a broader public. Oh,
I have no interest in that.
Okay, fine. All right.
I'm not in PR.
Right. Okay. Go
on. Yeah, I have no interest in that at all.
Okay.
But in your example,
Mars, let me just say, everybody on this table agrees that it's not, that psychoanalysis is not about the unconscious.
It's, of course, it includes the unconscious, but what do you mean by it? That's your question, I thought.
It is.
Yeah. But let's say, I don't think, for example, the notion of, I could go on about it. Remember the case of Lucy R., Freud's example of repression. He says to her, I put it to you that you're in love with your employer. She says, I know that. So he says, why didn't you tell me? And she says, well, I knew it, but it was uncomfortable. I pushed it out of my mind and it was embarrassing. That's his example of repression in his early papers. And then he gets tied up in drive theory and metapsychology and it becomes a totally different meaning. So the fact that it's viewed a certain way doesn't mean that we reflexively adopt that view.
Absolutely.
But take your work, where you have both subsymbolic coding, right?
Yeah.
Right?
That makes it easy.
It's not conscious. It goes on below consciousness.
Oh, no. It can be absolutely within
it. But it could be unconscious.
Everything can be.
Yes, exactly. Or maybe a better example is what George Klein, I loved his concept of, it's somewhat related to yours, of a hierarchy of connotations.
Yeah.
Every time you hear a word, it triggers, and Anne, of course, knows this area, it triggers not only the denotative meaning of the word, but a whole hierarchy of connotative association, a network of meanings. They're unconscious in that sense. However, the evidence that they're there is so interesting. If I give you the first letter of the word, it'll help. If I give you an associate of the word, it'll help. So clearly, there's an unconscious associative network that, by the way, might be conscious and might be not available to consciousness. I view those as better models of what's unconscious. Now, that's not the motivated unconscious. That's the way the mind works. The whole issue of the dynamic unconscious is really what psychoanalysis is about. We know that. The descriptive unconscious or the computational unconscious is not,
right.
I don't think psychoanalysis has much to contribute to that. The issue is, what is the nature of something unconscious repressed, the dynamic unconscious, right? Even your examples are really not the dynamic unconscious. You're talking about the way the mind works, not.
So are right? you. So are you.
I know. That's my point. Yeah. So how does one account for that part of what everyone thinks of as psychoanalysis, namely the repressed unconscious? That's really, I think, what you're asking, isn't it? Because people don't say, what's the unconscious in terms of computational unconscious? They know that psychoanalysis has nothing to say about that.
They mean the dynamic
unconscious.
I don't want to hog this because this could go on and on.
Okay. Anyway,
but we have some time.
Let me just say one more thing.
Sure.
Is that the repressed unconscious assumes an organized form that's put down, kept there, and then you work and you work through the dream work or you do whatever right. you do and you bring up that piece in its form.
Right.
And you know that's not true. You know that's
not true. It's not true. It's just not true. Yeah. Okay. So the way Mitchell, Steve Mitchell puts it, the model there is picking up a rock and seeing the ants that have been there all along. It's just not true. It's a bad model.
So that's why I said bringing up the notion of repressed unconscious doesn't help.
But that's the way people think of psychoanalysis.
Morris, it's always seemed to me too important that you found important. It's explanatory. Fingerettes, ideas of spelling out in consciousness and the levels of consciousness.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Another controversial area. I think a good part of the time, what we mean by defense or repression And this is an issue that Sartre already raised. As you know, Fingeret is a really fan of Sartre. That he gets it from Sartre, or Sartre. I don't know what the best pronunciation is. I show it. This reveals, as Paolo said, that I really am from Brooklyn. Sartre's example, begin with that. A woman, married woman, is having lunch with a man, and he takes her hand in his hand, and she leaves it there. And then he's encouraged by that, and he becomes increasingly open in his seduction. And when he becomes explicit, she's outraged and says, "How dare you say that to me?" And Sartre's response to that is, the woman is in bad faith. And what he means by that is she's complicit. She, after all, left her hand in his, and at some level she knew what he was about, but she pretended to herself that it's a self-deception issue. She pretended that she didn't know. So Fingeret raises a question of what's going on there. And he talks about, I don't want to take too much time. He talks about her not having articulated or spelled out the project that she was engaged in. And by the way, Donnell Stern essentially says something very similar, although he goes much too far with it, with his formulated and unformulated. There are certain budding experiences that we don't formulate further, we don't encode further, because very compatible with Freud's signal anxiety, because there's a signal of danger and you don't go any further. So my point here is there are very good ways of accounting for the kind of phenomena that are referred to by repression in the sense that we talked about before, that are far more faithful to actual processes and actual experiences. And they include not spelling out, not articulating, not formulating further, and so on. And anyway, that would be my one response to it. And there's much, much evidence for, I don't know, this is a statement you might find unacceptable. I don't know if there's evidence for repression in the form that it's often used. I don't know what evidence, even clinical evidence. Now take Lebowski's momentary forgetting. That's not repression in the way Freud meant. It's momentary forgetting, it's motivated, and then you remember again, so on. So what is the evidence for repression as a fully unconscious processes and it keeps things down in their original form? It's ridiculous in a way. Well, so.
Mauricio, are you there, Mauricio?
Hi, Morris. As always, a spellbinding presentation where you cover so much that it's hard to know where to start commenting on it. I want to go back to make two comments. One, going back to the issue that Larry brought up, and you're bringing up about the whole model of adaptiveness of the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is, what do organisms and what do humans adapt to? Mm-hmm. You know, we have to adapt to a certain realities that exist out there, and the function of the mind is to be able to respond to whatever we need to adapt in the environment in some coherent and organized fashion. If organisms didn't have a way to divide to respond in an organized fashion to the challenges in the environment, they would be wiped out by natural selection. So mm-hmm. There's a need to be able to develop a coherent response to how we're going to respond to the environment. Now, what makes humans somewhat different from other species is that, I didn't know I had my video off. What makes humans somewhat different to other species is that whereas some species do construct their own environments, you know, birds construct nests and termites construct their own nests. So some species are niche constructors. Mm-hmm. What makes humans really extraordinary is that we're extraordinary niche constructions. So what's the nature of the niche we construct? We call it cultures. That goes back to Bassanio's talk. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of cultures to which we need to adapt to. Now, is it always helpful, or is it to adapt to different cultures? Well, some cultures are detrimental to your mental health. But humans really are conformist animals. And it goes something to what Ray was saying about Bassanio's. You know, we are tribal animals that conform to the social norms in which we're raised. So there's a strong bias toward conformism in human nature, which is what makes us tribal animals. And it's very hard to get beyond the social filters that we get in the way of being able to understand, Bassanio's was saying, that to understand that the saying that, you know, the last thing a fish will ever recognize is he's surrounded with water. You know, we don't recognize that there's other ways to adapt because this is the way we were adapted to. So the issue of adaptiveness has to be raised into question in terms of human development, is what are we adapting to, and are what we are adapting to that we ourselves create really healthy or unhealthy for human well-being? So I just wanted to expand this issue, and humans in particular we're biologically prepared to adapt to the cultures we develop. And that's why we have this very extended development. We have the most extended development of any species on Earth, you know, which takes enormous amount of parental care and has huge costs. Well, for evolution to be able to pay for these huge costs, there had to be some benefit of being able to adapt to the cultures that we ourselves create. And that's why we have this very extended. And this goes to the issue about adaptive flexibility. You know, our mind is designed to be, have the most adaptive flexibility of any species on Earth because of this, that we're extraordinary in niche construction. So that was one comment, and I want your thoughts about that. And the other comment has to do with this whole view of the mind that you've been talking about. I don't know if you, Everett is here, so he could talk about this. I think Everett and Alan wrote a paper, a really extraordinary paper some time ago. And I think it was you, Everett, and correct me, with Alan Struve, the organizational model of the mind. And basically said what I'm saying, you know, the mind is designed to develop, is organized to develop a coherent approach to the environment. So this organizational model of the mind seems to me similar to what you're talking about, what the mind is all about in terms of ego psychology. Right. So from different directions, there's been views about the mind as an organizational structure. And my final comment, if we think of the mind as an organizational structure, why not, we could easily talk about the self as a metaphor for what this organizational structure do, or of the ego. You know, it's a question of language. So I don't see that self-psychology, if you think of self-psychology in terms of thinking of the self as an organizational model of the mind, is very different from what you're talking about, ego psychology. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, thanks. It's an awful lot. I'll try to respond to at least some of it. By the way, I totally agree with you about the, you know, the long helplessness in order to acquire cultural, social rules and skills. And that's why I have a long chapter on interpersonal and social understanding, you know, which is ignored by primarily by psychoanalysis, except for the notion of superego as an internalization of prohibitions mainly. And Fonagy makes an interesting point. He adds to Bowlby's notion of the adaptive nature of the attachment in terms of protection from predators. He talks about the development of an IIP, an interpersonal something. In other words, the one function of the attachment system is if we remain attached long enough, it provides greater and greater opportunity to learn and adapt to a particular culture through the medium of the family. So that's number two or three. I think Everett's paper was called Attachment as an Organizational Construct rather than Mind.
Everett, do you want to comment on that?
I think so. Wasn't that it, Everett?
Yeah.
Where is he?
Yeah, that's right. It was called Attachment as an Organizational
Construct. Okay. I know you talked about conformity as necessary to a powerful force as a culture. I think a distinction though should be made between the conformity, given the meaning it has, which it's much more compliance, social compliance, or which in Winnicott's theory would be called false self. You could engage in highly adaptive behavior and not conform to your culture. In fact, you can, you know, criticize and refuse to conform to certain aspects of your culture. So I wouldn't want those two terms equated. We already know what that led to with a misunderstanding of Hartman. What else? Let's see. The interesting metaphor of the fish in water, you know, that you mentioned. How did you put it? The fish doesn't know it's in water, right? Is that what you were saying? You know.
Correct.
Those are examples. I think that's a very important idea because it's, let's see, how do I put it? It really is a core issue in Ricoeur's notion of hermeneutics of suspicion in the following way. He refers to Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud as masters of suspicion. And basically, one of the things he elaborates on is what they all, that, why Marx, for example? Why should Marx and be put in the same category? It's because we are embedded in a culture without knowing, so to speak, our own embeddedness. And we take as for granted, as features of the world, the way the culture organizes our experiences. And that's very much, for example, little that I understand of Heidegger is the whole notion of being thrown into the world. And it's also at the core of Merleau-Ponty's notion of embeddedness in a culture. So in that sense, you're quite right. We perceive the world in ways that are determined by the culture in which we live that we don't have any idea. We think of it as absolute external reality, or as Nelson Goodman, the philosopher, put, we cut the world in at seams that we ourselves create and culturally create. So I think that's all a given. I mean, I don't think there's any real way of escaping at least the aspects of our embeddedness, because that's the nature of living in a world, I suppose. And isn't that the kind of thing that Nagel had in mind when he talks about what is it like to be a bat, for example? Do we even begin to understand the world in which other species are embedded? Or do we have this ineluctable, you know, gap between? It's also very Kantian in a way, namely, forget about culture for the moment, that the structures that we have determine completely the way we perceive the world. And if we had different cognitive structures, we would perceive the world in a very different way. Back to Goodman's notion, we might cut the world at different seams. So there's an embeddedness of these kinds that I don't think anyone can escape. Including cultural, but not just cultural. Also, you know, physiological. We're born with certain cognitive structures. Right? And they're selected in the course of evolution. So they have to bear a predictable relation to the thing in itself, otherwise we wouldn't survive. But there are various ways of cutting the world and surviving. You know, there was a whole movement years ago in philosophy. I don't know what happened to it. It was called, it combined philosophical notions with evolutionary notions, that philosophical ideas fade away or survive depending upon how useful they are in living in our particular external world. Oh, one final thing. You said we're shaped by our current culture, but we also, to use Bowlby's term, we're also shaped by the environment of evolutionary adaptedness, which is quite far removed from the current culture. And that's a real problem when you think about the conflict between that form of adaptedness and the adapted requirements of a given contemporary culture. Wouldn't you want to take that into account?
Indeed, I would take it into account. And because the problem, we see one problem to emphasize the fact that we're cultural beings, we're embedded in a culture, and that we can adapt to myriad forms of culture, is that it can easily lead to a form of relativism. We're a blank slate where each culture is going to write its own script, its own narrative. So mm-hmm. We're infinitely adaptable. I think that is incorrect. We were first adapted for 2 million plus years to live as nomadic hunter-gatherers in small societies where we had to cooperate, we had to develop pro-social norms, and we have to develop norms to help us be able to work in cooperative groups. Yeah. That is the evolution of environmental adaptiveness that prepared us to live in cultures.
Right.
So when cultures go against the basic capacity to feel connected with others, for mutual aid and to help others, which is what we were adapted to, it becomes unhealthy for human beings. So we have to keep in mind that there's been a long biological evolution that led us to become human as nomadic hunter-gatherers, which has been 95% of our existence as Homo species. And it's been only in the last 5,000 years that we've developed, you know, civilizations. So it's easy to lose sight of our prehistory and that really is what made us human.
Yeah. You know, it just occurs to me that, Rappaport's discussion of relative autonomy from the environment and relative autonomy from drives, and one guarantees the other, is quite relevant here. That basically what he was saying is, no matter how much a culture, like in, let's say, the book 1984, no matter how much it tries to control every aspect of your behavior, the guarantee, or at least the protective factor that prevents it from being absolute, is having biological and psychosexual drives. Remember that formulation? So there is that, and the other way around too, that you're saved from absolute boundedness to drives by having stimulation and adaptation to an external world. I always liked that concept because it gives one hope that there may be limits to how much you can be controlled. And it turns out it's no accident that, as I recall, in 1984, doesn't the government try very hard to rule out or control things like sex and love as dangers to the society? Does anyone remember it that way? So they try to destroy the sexual and the emotional as a way of exerting full control from the outside.
I've got David Lotto and then Larry. We got about a little less than 15 minutes left. Doing great, Morris. David Lotto, are you still there?
Yes, okay. I'm here.
Good.
Hi, David.
Hi, Morris. I've got two things. One of which you partially dealt with, but that's the issue of the criticism that comes from Lacan and his followers and disciples about the problem with ego psychology being that it's conformist. I know you kind of dismiss that, but there are a lot of people that sort of take it quite seriously. It becomes a political matter that ego psychology gets equated or aligned with American psychoanalytic conservatism, their rejection of various kinds of things that are considered heretical. So I wanted to ask you about what your comment about that was. And then another matter, the clinical versus metapsychology controversy that you mentioned back from George Klein and company, which seems to me is kind of morphed into hermeneutics versus essentialism, you know, as Hoffman talks about. So I want to, and as you mentioned, this is basically the mind-body or the mind-brain problem, how to integrate meaning and mechanism, or whether they can be integrated or not, as Rappaport wanted. So I just wanted to hear what you might have to say about that. Okay, let me leave it at that.
Okay. Thanks, David. I'm not sure I have anything further to add on the notion of ego psychology as conformist. I thought I dealt with that. So I don't know what else to say. I agree with you that a lot of people believe that and support that notion. On the other hand, a lot of people support Trump. can't resist saying that. So, you know, I think it's a misunderstanding of ego psychology for the reasons I tried to state before. The clinical versus metapsychology, I also thought I dealt with that. I think it was fed by the really very strong inadequacy of Freudian and Hartmanian specific form of metapsychology, which was eminently criticizable and should have been. So I think what happened is a rejection of that became a rejection. It became then a philosophical stance. A rejection of that specific form of metapsychology became a rejection of all experience distant, outside perspective forms of explanation. And I think that's a pretty accurate description of what went on. And you're right that then devolved into hermeneutics, not so much versus essentialism, but hermeneutics versus science or natural science, which isn't necessarily essentialist. So I think you're right in that description, and that continues. I don't see any inherent conflict between what's called hermeneutics and scientific explanation, in the sense that of course you have meanings and purposes and intentions, but you know, the quote from Max Black, surely you want to go on and discover the provenance and etiology of those meanings. And by the way, the concept of meaning is a very slippery concept. There, a lot of stuff written on the meaning of meanings. Wasn't that Richards who wrote that? Yeah. Anyway, so I don't think I have anything further to say on that, David.
Okay. I guess sort of another coda on that is, where are you on neuropsychoanalysis?
Well, I could tell you where I'm at. It's too sweeping, so, you know, keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that I've read in neuropsychoanalysis, and I was going to say, I don't want to name names, but I'll give you the initials. I'm kidding. It takes the following form. It's what I call, we knew this all along, and now neuroscientific findings have demonstrated that we were right. I think it applies to an awful lot of articles in that journal. And I don't think that contributes much. It would be very nice to read articles that say, we have some neuroscientific discoveries, shows in which the theory has to be challenged and modified and give us insight into phenomena that we, so on. There are some articles in neuroscience, I don't know if it's neuropsych, a lot of them are just finding neural correlates for psychological or behavioral phenomena, and they don't provide necessarily any great insight. However, there are some findings that are truly interesting and that I think advance our understanding. And I think the trick is to be able to distinguish between the two. I have to say, I have found such articles in other journals, but not very much in neuropsychoanalysis as a journal.
Okay, Larry, and then Paul Lippmann. Great.
I just in regard to that adaptation business, and along the lines of what Maurizio said, I think the way to consider Hartmann's concept of adaptation is the way adaptation has been used as a key to deciphering the nature of physiology, for example. If you assume that this is evolutionarily developed, you will see what function it serves, uh-huh. How it works with the other things as well. And I think he was reacting to a certain feeling in psychoanalytic theory that it was kind of called, that the cauldron image sort of was the central image of psychoanalysis. Mm. And what he was saying was, I think mainly that we have to assume that all these bits and pieces and the cauldron and so forth all work together for a purpose. And I think along with Rappaport's idea, that purpose will then serve to show what the identity of this creature is and give us an understanding of what function the parts serve and how they work together in some way. In which case you would say that adaptation in the ordinary sense that's being bandied about is one of the things that goes into the adaptedness. Adaptedness is the way we're designed to work together inside our head, that we're together, that we form a unit, that it makes sense, that things have evolved because they do function. And then something that can be done from time to time is what people ordinarily call adaptiveness, which is to get along with the environment or maybe not to get along with the environment. And I think that you can make that distinction, by the way. There's a political trap we can get into that we have to watch out for, I think, which would be that we decide ourselves somehow what is the optimum role. It's the current version of the old philosophical question, which bothers me, that philosophy decides what is, quote, the good life. So we look around, and philosophers usually find that the good life is the philosophical life. So we would like, we know, so the caricature would be we're adapted to a philosophical world. We don't believe any of that. But people will often feel that such and such a development in our world is clearly not what we were meant for. We were meant for something else. So you have to watch out, I think, for the idea that we're adapted to something that sort of coincides with our own feeling of what is a good life. But the other last point I'll make, and cease and desist, is I think that there's another reason for the caricature of Hartman adaptedness, Hartman's ego psychology, the great work that he was doing, which, by the way, I would say, of what is one of the advertisements for it, is that he was struggling to achieve something. He was struggling to make a theory. It's not a finished theory any more than Freud's was. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Even if we cannot unify meaning and cause, etc., all like that, you can still try to work on it. And I think that that's what we need to do. But there's another reason why, besides anti-Americanism and that the cliches, that the Continentals, for example, get enraged at the idea of ego psychology, is that if you think of, and this goes to Wilma's question too, if you think psychoanalysis is the science of the unconscious, mm-hmm. you now have a continent which belongs to you in which you can say any goddamn thing you want.
Right.
And yeah. if somebody says, wait a second, we have to put this to some other test, and say, well, you're just not a psychoanalyst. Mm-hmm. And that gives you an enormous empire to build in. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, Larry, that, well, the Continental, in the Bergman book, many of the Continental analysts, like Andre Green, his major criticism, he, by the way, ends up saying that Hartman injured psychoanalysis, harmed it. But his major reason, interestingly, is a rejection of ego psychology is not the one we have been talking about, but it's because it replaces drive, he argued. That was his main criticism, that it rejected drive theory, which is not true.
No, but maybe it goes beyond theory, because if you put the emphasis on drives and you have a certain kind of feeling about the id, the idea that it is a wild place.
Yeah.
You know, this is something with a law unto itself. It's not there because it evolved. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't mean to demean all the motives why somebody would want to say this is our field. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it gives a wide range to whatever you want to think, but it also does emphasize the kind of sort of free creativity that people on that side really want. They want to think that, you know, this is something special in mankind that isn't really adapted to anything. And it is just hell-bent for leather and really has that wildness in it. And I don't want it restricted by the idea that it is designed for something else. Don't you think that's true, Morris?
Yeah, I think that is one of their motives. Two things that come to mind in reaction to that and what you said before about the unconscious, any damn thing could go. You know, that was William James, one of his 10 arguments, you know, in his Principles of Psychology, he has 10 arguments for why we should not adopt the notion of unconscious into include the notion of unconscious into psychology. It's fascinating. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. What was it?
Yeah. And one of his arguments is, I wish I had the quote because it's very elegant. But he says to the effect of, once you open the door to explanation by unconscious, all sorts of nonsense and all sorts of scoundrels can enter. Because, you know, what are your criteria? So it's very much almost, you practically paraphrased what he said. The other thing about the wild id and the wild drives reminds me of two things. One is Wittgenstein's comment after he read Freud, and the other, you'll be amazed to know, a similar point was made by Jackie Mason, the comic. Wittgenstein and Jackie Mason. Wittgenstein said, when he read Freud, he said, you know, the man is a genius, but he's dangerous. Why is he dangerous? he said the following, which is can't be dismissed. He said, you know, if you tell people that in your unconscious there are wild, what's his description of the unconscious? It's like the witch's brew.
Seething.
A cauldron full of seething excitations, right? So Wittgenstein reacts to that and says, you know, you really think that people are threatened by that description? I think they're pleased by it. They think, oh my God, I didn't know I had that in me. So now we switch now to Jackie Mason. In one of his skits, he says, you tell an Italian woman that she's dressed like a prostitute, and the next day, Johnny, her husband, comes and breaks both your kneecaps. You tell a Jewish woman from Long Island the same thing. You know, you dress like a hooker. She says, you really think so? So, and that finally, the other association is this cartoon of the New Yorker where the psychiatrist is saying to this woman, let me tell you, deep down you're shallow. So I think we're threatened by shallowness, emptiness. We're not especially threatened by a seething cauldron. It's almost a compliment to say little old me has all that going on. And I think Wittgenstein had a very important insight into that. So I wonder to what extent this cauldron full of seething excitations is itself a fantasy.
Boris, you've gone for a long time. Why don't we just take Paul's question and then we can take a break?
Sure. Paul? Where is Paul? Oh, that's Paul. Well, now I can't hear. Can you hear me?
Okay, this is very fast.
I can hear.
Can you? This is very
I know who fast. You look like. Michael Steele.
Who is Michael Steele?
My former head of the Republican National Committee. I just realized that you kept thinking, my God, this guy looks like someone I've seen on TV.
He's a white Michael Steele.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, listen.
White, doesn't he?
This lousy technology has given us a great treat that we could hear and see Morris, all of us today, is a great treasure for us. And I want to thank the guys who have helped set it up and the people who have helped make this possible. A patient walks into a room for the first time and says, quote, they want to be called they from here on. Leads us to think, talking about herself. We need at some point to think about what that contributes, what that brings to our thinking about the self and the I and what that means. But I think the main thing for us now, for me, is the gratitude I feel for Morris to put into such eloquent terms the heart of ego psychology. It means a lot for us at this time. And I appreciate it deeply, Morris.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very, very much. All right. That's it.
Morris, thanks very much, Morris. Fantastic. We will, you just have to pretend you see everybody clap.
Okay. So we'll reconvene at what time?
Well, yeah, we'll take a break. Next talk is at 2:30. And so we'll take a break. But it occurred to me when people brought up the issue around the cocktail party, which Paolo and I forgot to take out of the agenda. There is not a cocktail party. But it does occur to me that if you all wanted to stay on and have lunch together, you could do that. I could leave it on. I can't do that. Yeah, but we can get back on at 2:30. I will leave the room on, though. People can stay here and talk and do whatever they like. But 2:30 is the time of our next talk with Ray. Okay. All right. Yeah. Good.
Yes. Morris, hello.
Oh, hi, Bart. Nice.